Another innovation, and that is the lecture demonstration of the Japanese No Theater. And this will be held in the old auditorium, the old UBC auditorium. And for those of you who are members, I have sent out this week a letter and earnestly ask you to reply if you want seats for this, because we anticipate an overflow audience. And we had rather a great difficulty with Dr. Margaret Mead, who drew so many people. So we're going to attempt to hold about 200 seats for our members until 8 o'clock, and then we'll have to let them go to the public, of course. So if you'll indicate, and if you've not received a letter, perhaps you'd be good enough to call into the Center for Continuing Education and ask for seats to be reserved. Thank you. May I call on Dr. Schrum?
Thank you. Madam Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, although this is International Women's Year, may I refer to you as Madam Chairman? I don't like Madam Chairperson, you know, and I don't care much for Chairwoman either. And so I looked up the dictionary to see, Webster's dictionary, see if I could be permitted to call you Madam Chairman, and it said, Chairman, the occupant of the chair of authority, the presiding officer of a meeting. I think you qualify. In any case, I understand there's a movement over at the university and the arts faculty to do away with the name bachelor's degree. They're going to call it, instead of bachelor of arts, person of arts. So in the arts, they're going to retain the master's, though, so that in the arts faculty, we shall have pa and ma degrees, you know. Well, my purpose this evening is a very pleasant one, is to introduce a man who everybody would say needs no introduction. I arrived in this university 50 years ago, and in 1925, and that year, the Rhodes Scholar was Dr. Harry Warren. In those days, I think Rhodes Scholars were somewhat even more important than they are today, because we had no law faculty, no medical faculty, there were no graduate school. There weren't very many opportunities for bright young students after they obtained their bachelor's degree. And the Rhodes Scholarship was very attractive, not only because of the prestige, but that was in the days before inflation, and the dollar value was quite attractive as well. Well, now I asked Harry if he would, I wanted to get the facts straight and introduction here, so I asked him if he would give me his curriculum vitae. And he did. Now, you didn't say, Madam Chairman, how many hours I could have on this, but the university has a form to be filled out. And Dr. Warren has filled out this form. And on the back here, there's a page for public service. Well, there are 42 items there. I don't know whether you wish me to read those or not. In any case, I think I'll just put that down, Harry. Thanks for sending it to me. And just give you a few of the highlights that I happen to remember about Harry's career. First of all, I say I knew him when I arrived here as the Rhodes Scholar from British Columbia for 1926. He went to Oxford for 3 years. He obtained a Bachelor of Science and a D.Phil. And this is, and he also has 2 degrees, I should say, from British Columbia, a Bachelor of Arts and a Bachelor of Applied Science. After 3 years at Oxford, he went to California Institute of Technology as a Commonwealth Fellow, and he was there for 3 years. And then after this, you might say, 6 years of graduate work beyond UBC, he returned to the faculty as an instructor, and he's been on the staff ever since. Now, in the Department of Geology. I don't know too much about geology, but I do know here about 15 years ago that Dr. Warren became very interested in trace elements and using these trace elements to locate mines. Now, I was on the National Research Council at the time, and we financed some of these projects of his, or say the National Research Council did, and I believe that he was one of the first in any part of the world to get the idea that if there are plants growing in an area where there's copper ore underneath, that if one had instruments sensitive enough, one could detect traces of copper in the leaves of those trees and plants. Now, a great number of people thought this was nonsense, you know, but he had to prove it. And so in order to prove it, he set up here at the university techniques for measuring very, very small, tiny traces of various metals in organic substances. Well, all I want to say without expanding this too far is that this is grown into a field of activity known as geochemistry. And I think probably every mining property today is investigated, the grasses and leaves and plants, to check to see if there is any trace of some of these elements of copper, lead, or zinc, or whatever it may happen to be. Now, this also had an interest to people who are interested in trace elements in regard to health, because if you have the techniques for measuring minute quantities of metals, then you might be able to apply it to those trace elements which are necessary for the health of human beings or animals or even of plants. And because of his work in this field, Dr. Warren has been invited to many parts of the world to discuss this subject, and particularly before groups of physicians and medical research people. He's been to Russia and England and various parts of the world. Now, I could say a word or two about his athletic prowess. I see Malcolm McGregor here tonight. All good cricketers support each other. And Dr. Warren and Malcolm McGregor and so on, they are great supporters of cricket. But Dr. Warren has been a supporter of all forms of amateur athletics. I don't think he's ever been very enthusiastic about professional athletes and their activities. But he has supported amateur athletics, all except, I think, probably Canadian football, Harry. But in any case, English rugby and cricket and field hockey particularly. Well, he was also an athlete at Oxford, I believe, in the European Games. He won the 100-yard dash for Oxford University and the 200-yard dash. So he can scamper a bit as well. And since this is the year, International Women's Year, I want to say show you that he's no male chauvinist, that he was the honorary president of the Women's Field Hockey Association for 7 years, 1964 and 1971, British Columbia. He was the honorary president of the Canadian Women's Field Hockey Association for 3 years, 1968 to 1971. And also, I think, too, since it's International Women's Year, again, you know, the federal government was spending $5 million to advertise this. Why shouldn't I do a little bit here for nothing? But in any case, I think, you know, Harry would not have accomplished all he has accomplished in life if he hadn't married a very charming British Columbia girl, Margaret Tisdale. So I think that Women's International Years had made some contribution to the success of one of our most distinguished professors at the University of British Columbia. I must also tell you what he's going to talk about. That's really what I should have done in the first place and sat down, but he's going to speak on gold or dross, and he has a subtitle, The Romantic Past and Future Potential of BC's Mineral Wealth. Professor Warren.
Thank you, Gordon. All right? Right. Madam Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, I think I could almost say friends. There are so many familiar and friendly faces here. First of all, thank you, Dr. Shrum, for those kind words. I was going to say that getting old has very few advantages, but when you can make a nice lot of remarks like that about another old man, I think there are some advantages. Before I get into my talk, may I say that I owe a great debt to several people. First of all, to Jim Tough of the Mining Association of British Columbia, to Professor Evans of the Mineral Engineering Department, and to Rick Higgs and Tommy Elliott of the BC and Yukon Chamber of Mines. All these people have suffered a great deal. I've been pestering them to give me the information, the facts that I needed to build this talk. Now, I suppose you realize too well that this fancy advertising, Gold or Dross, was an attempt to bring a few people in this evening. I think it might better have been why I believe in the future of mining in British Columbia. Now, the more perspicacious members of this audience will hardly need to be told that I could hardly be called an unbiased witness. I admit that the mining industry in the past may have made some mistakes. However, these mistakes can be remedied, and it is my hope and belief that mining will, for many years, continue to play a vital part, not only in maintaining, but also in expanding our provincial economy. Now, this evening, I propose to break up my remarks into three parts. To begin with, I shall attempt to explain why my training, largely at this university, forces me to the conclusion that if our mining industry is ever hamstrung, every citizen in our province will be the loser. Secondly, I propose to review as succinctly as possible the history and development of mining in this province and explain why it should not be treated as if it were a renewable resource such as water power, agriculture, forestry, or fishery. And neither should it be regarded as a secondary occupation, such as manufacturing, not even as being akin to any of the tertiary or service industries, such as banking, communication, or transportation. Thirdly, I intend to deal with some of the major criticisms directed at our mining industry by putting some of these criticisms in perspective. Then, by taking some concrete suggestions for improvement, attempt to win your understanding and hopefully your support for an industry that directly or indirectly provides you with approximately 25 cents out of every dollar that you handle throughout your life. Now, turning to my first theme, why I believe that mining should be permitted to play an important part in British Columbia, I have to admit right away that my knowledge of economics is limited. Fortunately, the University of British Columbia, largely through the efforts of two men, provided me with some fundamental ideas which are simple and they appear to have stood the test of time remarkably well. These men were the late Professor Boggs, Teddy Boggs to most of us, and the late Professor Wilkins, who gave us a course entitled Engineering Economics. I carried away from these two magnificent teachers some basic ideas that are worth repeating and may be summed up as follows. Now, the choice of words is my own, but I hope I am reflecting what they tried to teach us. Wealth can best be defined as goods and services which bring satisfaction. Money is merely a convenience for the bartering and exchange of these goods and services. Two, inflation is merely a reflection of the fact that at some particular period, money and credit are relatively more abundant than our goods and services. Three, working populations may be divided into three groups. A, the primary, those who produce basic wealth, farmers, foresters, fishermen, miners, and producers of energy not falling into any of the above categories. These are the workers who supply our basic needs, our food, and our clothing and shelter. Secondary, those who integrate, who wed raw materials and energy so that they are available to us in an acceptable form and are represented by workers in construction and manufacturing. Tertiary, all those who are not included in either of the above categories fall into this group, and amongst others, of course, include doctors, lawyers, politicians, merchants, university professors, judges, bankers, policemen, clergymen, and a host of others who make very valuable contributions to running our modern society. Now, at this point, one must state most emphatically that the foundations of a modern society lie in having a sound background of at least one and preferably several primary industries. Probably most people recognize that the more sophisticated our society becomes, the greater the proportion of tertiary workers there will be in that society. What apparently is not always remembered is the fact that many of the pleasures of civilization, such as symphony concerts, dramatic productions, and athletic spectacles, are all made possible by some form of primary production. The connection is so indirect that its importance is not recognized by many. I doubt very much if the Canucks, the Lions, or the late lamented Mounties were much concerned with the far-reaching effects of Bill 44 and Bill 31. What is referred to as our democratic way of life is founded on the principle of one person, one vote. Unfortunately, to operate this utopian principle in a satisfactory manner, it is necessary to have an informed democracy, and in this respect, we have failed lamentably. In any election, if we may judge what happens in BC and in Canada, everybody appears to vote on the basis of two basic principles. One, everybody making more than they are should be taxed more heavily, and contrarywise, everybody getting less than they are probably getting as much as they deserve. Two, every individual knows his own business best and at the same time feels that what is best for him must be best for the country. It follows naturally that an individual must vote for whatever party professes a policy that promises to provide that individual voter with the best rewards. It just happens that after World War I, our working force was more or less equally divided between primary, secondary, and tertiary occupations. Today in Canada, only about 10% of our occupied population are engaged in primary industries, whereas approximately 60% are in tertiary jobs. Approximately the same disposition holds for British Columbia. Throughout recent years, the primary workers, aided by vast and steadily increasing amounts of energy, have been able to supply the necessary increased demands for wealth made by the growing proportion of their non-wealth-producing citizens. Today, for the first time, we face an energy crisis. The cost of energy in recent months has escalated even faster than the general rate of inflation, and a position has been reached where all our automation, integration, and ingenuity are unable to make it possible for the shrinking number of primary workers to provide the amounts of wealth needed to supply the wants of everybody, including those whose function is only to integrate or distribute it. It seems to me to be absolute nonsense to assume that our governments do not know what to do about inflation and unemployment. They know only too well what should be done. However, we must remember that governments are composed of eminently practical men and women. One of the functions of governments is to govern, and to govern, a government must get elected. Hence, governments do precisely what they think they must do to get re-elected. Politicians also know that tertiary workers, directly or indirectly, make up 60% of the country's workforce, and thus effectively control elections. It stands to reason that these tertiary workers, many of whom dedicate their lives to promoting social justice and distributing wealth, have more knowledge in these spheres of activity than they have in dealing with and understanding the problems of those who are engaged in producing wealth. And until the primary workers can win support from other sections of the population, their chances of once again winning appropriate legislation are slim. It is surely paradoxical that so many young men and women, when they are faced with the choosing of a career, opt for one of the tertiary occupations, which in all likelihood will condemn them to spend much of their life in cities. Yet these people are wont to extol the virtues of fresh air and water and clamor for an undisturbed and unpolluted environment. They go fishing, and some of the more affluent even go so far as to praise the simple life and on occasion operate a small farm, although one may suspect that this last exercise merely provides a way by which income tax may be modified. When it was known that I was taking prospecting parties into the hills, there were many mothers who asked if I could not find a place for their sons. The great majority of these boys honestly stated that they had no intention of following mining or geology as a career. They were not engaged. Nevertheless, it is gratifying to be able to report that some of these boys who opted for the outdoors life have found in it great satisfaction, and a few, by any measure, have obtained adequate rewards. In this, the names of Colin Godwin, Gordon Davis, and Earl Dodson come to mind, and I hope they will not mind my giving them as examples. Now, just to wind up this portion of my talk, it may be in order to give a table showing the part played by the primary producers and their relationship with the total income of British Columbia. These figures were prepared for a conference held in Bellingham last September. And at this conference, legislators and technical personnel from the state of Washington and the province of British Columbia exchanged ideas. Now, where can I get this thing on this? Here, right. Now, if you just glance at that, you'll see that actually British Columbia produces more primary wealth than the state of Washington. And yet the total value of the gross product is less. And the reason, of course, is that we do not apply these raw materials and energy, unite them together satisfactorily. Now I'd just like to show the breakdown to show you where mining has come in the British Columbia. Now you'll see by this that if you take forestry and mining, they account for approximately 75 cents of every dollar that you spend throughout your life in British Columbia. It is quite different in the state of Washington, where mining accounts for only 3.4% of their provincial income. Although the experts here no doubt will find out their own industry and see how it has performed relative to the others. I might say that in a well-industrialized society, that factor relating the gross provincial or national product, as you will, and the value of the raw materials and energy jumps as high as 15, and in most good societies it'll be between 5 and 7. So that we are not by any means the worst, but we still have a long way to go. The above data should serve to show how mining has played and continues to play a mining important part in the economy of British Columbia. Any diminution in the mining output will sooner or later diminish the wealth and standard of living available to British Columbians. In support of and to emphasize my remarks, I would like to quote from a speech made last November by Lord Robins, former head of the nationalized coal mines of Great Britain. And I quote, "We are psychological sufferers from our industrial past. The words wealth and profits ring in the ears of so many people as an obscenity. Some people do not seem to realize that it is the creation of wealth that enables people to be prosperous, and that it is the creation of wealth that enables a nation whose desire is for what is called social justice to provide for those who are not able to provide for themselves." End quote. It is sometimes claimed that mining is not contributing its fair share to the public weal. Obviously, this claim is subject to debate. But if one may assume the integrity of Price Waterhouse and Company, the following table prepared for the Mining Association of BC should be of interest. If you look at this table, you will see that of the approximately $1 billion taken in by the mining companies of British Columbia in 1973, 379 million were expended on supplies. And you'll notice the amount given to the shareholders is a very modest amount. The dividends paid were only 5% of that total. The interest paid on loans, somewhat, just a little less, and the taxes paid, as you see on this chart, quite a substantial amount. Another large sum of money there goes to paying back the money that was borrowed to put those mines into operation. And of course, as soon as that money is paid back, then that will be divided between the shareholders and the government, so that all in all, the government takes a very tidy share of the income. And I think these figures pretty well speak for themselves. At all events, I now propose to outline how an industry which was only producing between 15 and 20 million of dollars annually at the turn of the century and 140 million in 1950 jumped to nearly 500 million in 1970 and 1,000 million in 1973. And not all this increase was the result of inflation, nor was it the result of accident. And this leads me to my brief history of mining in British Columbia. I don't know what historians would do, but I've divided British Columbia mining history into four major periods. The first, from 1811 to 1871, when coal and gold were the only two major products, and which, as I'm going to show, helped to open up British Columbia. And then we had probably, in retrospect, one of the most exciting periods of any country anywhere in the world, from 1871 to 1901, when the discovery, in addition to gold and coal, copper, lead, zinc, and silver. And then we had a period of 1901 to 1941, which, with a few very minor exceptions, there was not a single, well, Zabalus, one or two others you can name, but there were a few made, no major discoveries. We lived on the heritage of the past. And this, as Dr. Shrum may remember, was a feature of some of my speeches in the 30s, when I said that unless we could find some new way of discovering and opening up mines, that we were going downhill steadily. And as I'll show you later, we actually produced less per capita in 1961 than we did in 1901. That's not always realized. Whereas in 1971, in 1973, we reached a production of four times that per capita of what we'd ever had before. Now, while BC was busy emerging as a mining center, it's rather interesting to look on what was going elsewhere. California in 1949, New South Wales in 1849, New South Wales in 1851, Nevada in 1859, and the South Island of New Zealand in 1861. And as T.A. Rickard has so aptly noted, trade follows the flag and the flag follows the pick. In all the above cases, gold was the catalyst that led to the opening up of hitherto relatively undeveloped country. Much could be said of the early discoveries in British Columbia, but I'm going to just mention three. In order better to explore the British Columbian coast and to develop trade, the Beaver was built in Britain and sailed round the Horn in 1835. The Hudson Bay factor of the time feared that she would prove to be an expensive luxury, a fear that was strengthened by her first trading mission on which, and I quote from Professor Ormsby, she took along a crew of 31, including 4 stokers and 13 woodcutters, finding use for the services of all as she voraciously consumed 26 cords of wood every 3 or 4 days. Professor Ormsby continued, "The ugly little tramp with her high protective sides, her single black funnel, and her side wheels proved her worth by skillfully negotiating narrow channels, establishing on her first cruise the truth of Indian reports of coal deposits at the northern end of Vancouver Island." Actually, the first coal to be mined in British Columbia resulted from a find near the present site of Nanaimo in 1852. Quoting Townsley now, Governor Douglas wrote, quote, "Progress has been rapid and satisfactory, with the coal measuring from 6 to 7 feet in thickness on a safe and commodious harbor from which it could be shipped at trifling cost." However, it was gold, more than any other single factor, that aroused the cupidity and kindled the imagination and enthusiasm of the thousands of men who were destined to open up and develop the interior of British Columbia. To those of us who know something of the caribou, some of the historic names are enough to make one's blood flow faster. Antler, Cunningham, Grouse, Keithley, Lightning, and Williams Creek, and Lowhee and Stout's Gulch were all a part of my first experience with the Canadian Geological Survey. 2 short quotes from Professor Ormsby should serve to explain the lure of the caribou, and I quote, "But the gold of Williams Creek, both in quantity and in value, exceeded any other. This was the Great Creek of Caribou, the creek that in 1862 attracted adventurers from Europe, the British Isles, the Atlantic seaboard, and Canada. At the Cunningham claim, 4 partners recovered 675 ounces in one day. That's nearly $120,000 at today's price. And in 3 months' labor, returned a net profit of $10,000 for each man. That's $87,500 at today's prices. And the steel single claim, 409 ounces were obtained in a single day, $71,000 in a single day. These results, combined with Dick Willoughby's success at Lightning Creek, where he and his partners recovered 3,037 ounces of gold, worth about $50,000 then, and $531,000 at today's prices, has convinced Douglas that the building of a better system of communications was necessary in order to exploit more fully the resources of the caribou. Thus was the Caribou Highway initiated. However, more than 100 years were to elapse before it reached its present state, and some 70 years before a viable lode gold mine was to be developed. Coincidentally with the development in the caribou came reports of rich new diggings at Wild Horse Creek, flowing into the Kootenai River about 50 miles north of the international border. This new development resulted in Governor Seymour deciding that the Dewdney Trail would have to be extended from Hope to Wild Horse Creek, which is Fort Steele, just near Fort Steele, in order to stop trade flowing south to the American towns in the Columbia. Thus it was that gold, and gold alone, caused the building of the travel routes which today are represented by the caribou and the Southern Trans-Canada highways. and an alert traveler can see vestiges of the original roads when they journey along either the Fraser Canyon or the Hope-Princeton highways. Had these highways resulted only in the production of gold, they might have justified the money spent on them. However, considering mining alone, let alone eventually the forestry and agricultural developments that followed, these roads helped to usher in one of the most widespread mineral developments ever seen in Canada. The Dewdney Road facilitated the discovery and opening up of precious and base metal mines that were found in the Princeton, Greenwood, Rossland, Weimar, Sheep Creek, and Kimberley districts. This brings us to the second period in the history of mining in British Columbia. It is the years 1871 to 1901. Now, it's well to remember that all the discoveries of this period had one thing in common. Every one of the discoveries of this were either placer, or in the case of the next group, were all outcrops that came right to the surface, so that you did not have to have any fancy techniques to find them. The late S.G. Blaylock of Cominco was wont to remark, three things are necessary to find a mine: brains, guts, and luck. And during the 30 years, guts and luck seemed to have been the features necessary for success. One or two comments about some of the other, about the above discoveries, may be of interest to a lay audience. Although Robert Sproul is credited with the final staking in 1882 that later led to the development of the Bluebell Mine, it had been known to Indians for at least 50 years previously. Sproul never lived to profit by his discovery, for he was hanged for shooting Hamill, who, acting for two brothers by the name of Ainsworth, had overstaked Sproul's original claims. The case was fought out in the courts. Sproul won in the Kootenays, where he was well known, but the Ainsworth and Hamill appealed the case to a higher court and won, which led Sproul to take the law into his own hands with tragic results. Not all the discoveries of the period had such bloody and tragic endings. J.B. Tyrrell, acting as student assistant to the great G.M. Dawson, is credited with spotting at their campsite a piece of ferny coal. Dawson, a truly remarkable man who covered much of British Columbia, is credited with first observing mineralization at Headley. And it was Charles Kempsel, also of the Geological Survey of Canada, who later reported on the cobalt bloom where the Headley Nickel Plate Glory Hole now stands. Each one of the other camps listed in Table 5 is worthy of a story on its own. In virtually every case, the principal successes can be credited to either a single man or a small group of men who, in the face of much discouragement, showed a remarkable degree of imagination, perspicacity, stubbornness, and unquenchable enthusiasm. With a few notable exceptions, these are not the collective qualities possessed either by civil servants or politicians. This is not the chief reason for my profound belief. This is the chief reason for my profound belief that until a much later stage in our development, we should leave a prominent, if not dominant, place in the mining industry for private enterprise and what is generally referred to as the free enterprise system. I'd like to illustrate the point I'm trying to make with three illustrations. The Sullivan Mine was staked in 1892. For 28 years, it was generally reckoned to be a small mine with some high-grade plums of lead ore and some zinc. However, because in most of the mine, the lead and zinc minerals were so intimately mixed that they could not be separated economically, metallurgical problems virtually forced the closure of the mine in 1907. Actually, the Crow's Nest Pass Company started an action and obtained a judgment, making a seizure for an unpaid coal bill. Eventually, the company, now known as Cominco, a subsidiary of the Canadian Pacific Railway, took over from the Fort Steele Mining Company, whose control had been vested in the Federal Mining Company, in which the Guggenheim interests of New York had been involved. The problem of the complex ore was eventually solved in 1920 by the adoption of what metallurgists call the differential flotation process, a process which had its first commercial application when it was applied to the Sullivan ore. The development of this new and innovative idea has resulted in the Sullivan mine being for 50 years one of the greatest, if not the greatest, producer of lead and zinc in the world. For our second story, which involves brain as well as guts and luck, we turn to the Rosslyn camp. Here in the spring of 1893, a young mining engineer by the name of Frank Loring was sent to examine the Josie mine by a Patsy Clark of Spokane. And I'll let Townsley take up the story from here. Josie's samples assayed consistently good values, in fact, too good, and prompted Patsy Clark to send a crew the following May to resample the ground. But the resampling gave low values, and Clark, the suspicious Irishman, averred that the mine had been salted and was ready to transfer his interest in the Josie mine to anyone who would reimburse him his $12,000. Young Loring, with all the confidence that goes with youth and a sampling job well done, took a 30-day option in June and started east to raise the money. But times were hard, money was scarce, so only when an obliging friend proffered him his railway mileage book of tickets was he able to journey to Milwaukee to raise the necessary $12,000 from a doctor friend, but not until 3 hours before the option expired. 3 hours difference in time zones enabled a telegram to clinch the deal and bring wealth to himself and his friends. When he returned to the property, a few hours' work uncovered an ore body 50 feet wide where he had done his original sampling for Clark, and assays confirmed the correctness of it. End quote. Frank C. Loring was paid $700,000, a real payoff for having had faith in his good judgment and belief in the Josie showing. Our last anecdote concerns the Britannia mine and is particularly interesting to any British Columbian interested in innovative and useful ideas in which the University of British Columbia has been connected. As early as 1865, copper float had been reported in the Howe Sound area, but it was not until 1898 that Oliver Furry, a trapper, staked the nucleus of what was to become the Britannia mine. After many complications and a series of disasters which would make a lecture in themselves, Britannia was faced with building a new mill to replace that burnt in 1921. To this new mill came C.G. McLaughlin, a young graduate fresh from the University of British Columbia. And at this point, again, I'll let Townsley take over. McLaughlin occupied his spare time from his menial job about the plant, trying unofficially to improve the flow sheet. Backed by the courage given by his research, he blandly approached the manager and suggested changes, which was nearly equivalent in those days to altering the laws of the Medes and Persians. He was rather bluntly received, being instructed to work out his experiment in practice and see the result. The matter was dismissed from the manager's mind, but in the meantime, serious-minded McLaughlin took his boss literally and started to work. The surprise came when a few weeks later he again approached his chief and told of his success. Success with what? Why, the improved flow sheet, said the astonished McLaughlin. The general manager now listened attentively, and he gave serious thought to the young graduate's development, then telegraphed to New York, better send along an expert. Think we have an improvement in the flow sheet. And improvement it was, which was adopted. And this was the start up the ladder of success for C.G. McLaughlin, who later presided over the huge mill at Noranda, engaged Canada's famed copper producer. It is worth recording that McLaughlin, when not engaged in his studies, coached the university's rugby team when they regarded the McKechnie Cup as their permanent property. If we remember that it was a group of McGill graduates who were involved in introducing differential flotation, it may be seen from these few examples that brains were taking their place besides guts and luck in mining enterprises. Our third period, from 1901 to 1941. As must be realized by what has already been discussed, these years were marked not by new discoveries, but by development of discoveries made before the turn of the century. The late 20s and early 30s saw the Great Depression in full swing, and those of us who experienced that period have no wish for a repetition of those hard times. In the early 30s, the price of gold was raised from $20 to $35 an ounce, and this caused a revival in many of the old camps and the discovery of one new one, Zabalus. It became increasingly apparent that if new mines were to be developed, novel prospecting, financing, and mining methods would have to be introduced. Most of the easily discovered surface showings had been found. Geophysical and geochemical techniques that could give some hint of what might be beneath the mantle of drift and soil overlying bedrock became necessary prospecting tools. Large, low-grade, disseminated copper showings had long been known, but it was not practical to develop them by underground methods. It was expensive to develop large tonnages of low-grade material, and it was even more expensive to put them into production as large open-pit operations. Before the turn of the century, a few hundred thousand, or at the most a few million dollars, were all that were necessary to bring a mine into production. To bring a major mine into production would now call from between 50 to 400 millions of dollars. And this kind of money, because of the high risk factor, does not become available unless the political climate is satisfactory and tenure and taxation are compatible with the risk involved. Representations to senior governments were made by various. The government heeded the appeals of the mining industry and initiated generous depletion allowances on mining profits, tax holidays in quotation marks, for new mines, and immediate write-off for exploration and development expenditures. These concessions represented major federal income tax incentives to the mining industry. These incentives typically resulted in lower effective income tax rates on mining industry profits than the rates imposed on other industries. They could be justified on the basis of mining being a basic industry and highly speculative because of its unpredictability and exhaustibility. Unhappily, World War II then came, and it was not until the later 1940s that mining companies were able to take advantage of the wise and stimulating laws that had been passed. Understandably, much has been made of successful mining ventures, but before passing on, I would like to draw attention to some of the unsuccessful and consequently unsung and often unrecorded heroes of the exploration world. Perhaps typical of these was John Gruhl, who in the Bridge River, during a 25-year period, single-jacked some 1,700 feet of tunnel in hard rock without achieving his objective of finding ore. Williamson near Zamora, north of Rock Creek, Trimble on Stirba Creek, northwest of Clinton, and Morris at Tatlioko Lake in the Chilcotin, carried out similar handwork and failed to find their mother lode. I don't know how many in the audience, one or two I suspect, have done single jacking, and those who have, I wish you would take an opportunity of trying to convince your neighbors at the end of this talk what it's like to try and drive a tunnel 1,700 feet in hard rock with no machinery whatsoever, doing your own steel sharpening and doing everything with your good right arm. No wonder we in the mining industry were upset when the federal government removed the tax-free provisions on the prospector's once-in-a-lifetime strike. I hope you had a chance while I was talking to digest those names. I assume that talking to a group of British Columbians, you know where most of those places are, but if you don't, I hope you'll ask in the question time afterwards. But it was true that when we were talking all the way through the 30s and 40s, we emphasized the fact that we were living off the work done by our forebears, and that, with, I say, one or two notable exceptions, practically nothing of major consequence was found. Now, these are some of the most exciting years that some of us have lived through, because we had staked a great deal in persuading the government that if they would give these incentives to the industry, particularly the quick accelerated write-off and the once-in-a-lifetime tax remission for the discoverer, that we would produce results. And I would beg you to try and think of what our feelings were through these 10 or 15 years while we waited and hoped that these discoveries would be made. And most of these discoveries, but not all, were the result of the new political climate, the new taxation, and new techniques, geophysics and geochemistry. Some of them were a refurbishing of old things, but they were pretty exciting. I mentioned that the price of gold was raised in the 1930s, and before inflation reared its ugly head, British Columbia could boast 25 operating gold mines. The last of these closed in 1973. The Pinchy Lake Mercury Mine was discovered in 1937 by a University of British Columbia graduate in geology, J.G. Gray, who was working under the direction of J.E. Armstrong of the Geological Survey of Canada. Armstrong was also a graduate of the University of British Columbia, having taken his degree in geological engineering. This mine in the years 1940 to 1944 was brought into operation as a war measure by Cominco and produced more than 4 million pounds of mercury, and was the largest single producer of mercury on this continent, or indeed in the British Commonwealth. In 1968, it reopened, and by 1972 and 73, it was producing several hundred tons of mercury annually. Cassiar asbestos was discovered in 1950 and commenced production in 1952, and is now producing some of the highest grade long fiber asbestos produced in the world. I'll have some more to say about those mines. I want to leave that on while I just say a few words about some of them. The stories behind each of these mines is worth telling, but some of them must keep for another time. If I choose Bethlehem to illustrate the difficulties of developing a mine of this type in BC, it is because I know some of the men involved, and in a very minor way, I was personally informed about some of the problems Spud Huestis had in getting this mine off the ground. My first meeting with Spud was in the summer of 1942, when with Charlie Ney, he was prospecting for Pioneer Gold Mines. Some 10 years later, one of my prospecting partners, Ferdy Brent, took a senior member of a major mining company over Spud's ground. This ground and much of the Highland Valley was optioned by the company in question. Not long afterwards, that company withdrew when a senior official from outside BC pointed out to our BC chief that, and I quote, "a little copper stain goes a long way," end quote. The remainder of the story would come better from Spud himself, but I think it is correct to say that most of the major mining companies operating in Canada were approached with negative results. During this period, we were carrying out soil and plant sampling of various properties, including Bethlehem. and we were actually permitted to publish our results, which indicated that there were anomalies over what are now the Iona and the Jersey ore bodies. I doubt if anybody read, much less took any notice of our report, prepared in 1956, published in 1958. In the end, it was the Sumitomo Group of Companies of Japan who provided the $5.5 million to put the mine into production. Incidentally, it is worth noting that the production plan and economic analysis in which Sumitomo based their decision was prepared by Wright Engineers Limited in association with J.A. Ross, Pieng, all of Vancouver. And as some of you know, both Harold and Len Wright and J.A. Ross are all Harold University of BC degrees. I'd like people to remember that when we're asked to provide useful and innovative programs in this university. It would be difficult to find a better illustration of the importance of free competition and the value of foreign capital. It would be hard to imagine any government bureaucracy succeeding in overcoming the obstacles set up before Spud Huestis and his colleagues. In the latest report I have from Bethlehem, I'm sure you don't want the details, but I must mention that, again, the direct taxes paid by the company and employee income taxes amounted to over 20% of their gross income. You can imagine what that is in terms of net income. At all events, this operation, how this operation could be called a ripoff, passes my understanding. Visits to Ashcroft before Bethlehem and now should serve to show the value of Spud Huestis' efforts. He has turned waste rock into wealth, and very tangible wealth at that. Not so many years ago, the slogan, work and wages, was popular. Bethlehem Copper Corporation has provided work and wages for hundreds of men, and all because of the initiative, persistence, and dogged determination of Spud Huestis and his associates. It is worth noting that three UBC grads were involved in helping Spud outline the geology of Bethlehem. The late Drs. Bill White and Bob Thompson, and Dr. McTaggart, who is very much alive still. Many of the other mines listed in Table 6 have had similar histories. Mineralization was known at the Stella, which you see here. It's in Daco. And now, the second largest mine that was at the time in the British Commonwealth, and the largest molybdenum mine in Canada. This had been known for many years, and exploratory work had been concentrated on small, relatively high-grade veins. When development of these high-grade veins had been disappointing, the claims were allowed to lapse. And even though a reputable publication had reported a challenging geochemical anomaly as far back as 1953, it was not until 1957 that the late Dr. Christopher Riley restaked the ground, and which is now the Endako mine. Dr. Riley also had held a degree from the Geology Department of the University of British Columbia. It would be only fair to mention that it was the advanced technology associated with large-scale open-pit mining that enabled Endako to become a viable operation. I think it would be fair to say that in addition to the development of techniques in large-scale open-pit mining and more steady demand for base metals, asbestos and mercury, and more recently gold and silver, the actual and projected mining developments in British Columbia would never have come about had it not been for the incentives put into law by that earlier Liberal government and the initiative shown by a dedicated group of prospectors, geologists, mining engineers, and promoters. Yes, I believe that promoters have a place in the scheme of things. But please remember that the honest promoter treads a difficult path. He must have a degree of optimism, or our fellow citizens, more prone to buy sweepstake tickets or savings bonds, will not buy. He should be aware of his client's ability to afford to gamble or speculate. Most properties are a gamble in their early stages of development. It is usually only after the expenditure of several millions of dollars that they may be justified as speculations. Relatively few companies advance to the extent that their common stock may properly be considered of investment caliber. As an aside, I wonder how many of you noticed in the recent disclosure of holdings by our politicians how few of them held mining stock of either speculative or investment caliber. This fact might go a long way towards explaining why, in some quarters, the payment of dividends to shareholders is not rated as a contribution to society. A word about Grand Duc mines. In 1948, a prospector named Ina Cavalli staked some claims in the Duc area. In 1951 and 1952, Ina Cavalli and Tom McQuillan staked further claims on behalf of Helicopter Exploration Limited. In 1953, Granby took an option on the property and formed a company, Grand Duc Mines Limited, to handle the development of the claims. From 1954 to 1962, 14 years from the discovery, diamond drilling and exploration was carried on, with Newmont Mining Corporation and Granby Mining Company Limited sharing the cost. A first feasibility made in 1963 showed 32.5 million tons of ore, averaging 1.93% before dilution. By 1964, some 55 million had been spent, and it had been decided that a 10.3-mile tunnel would have to be driven through the mountains to link the mining operation with the concentrator. In 1965, an engineering appraisal was completed, 17 years after the discovery, and this indicated a much higher capital requirement would be needed than had previously been estimated. Eventually, the tunnel, underground, and surface installations were completed, and operations commenced after $135 million of private capital had been used up. Low copper prices and numerous startup problems led to a loss of over $6.5 million by December the 31st, 1972. Incidentally, I understand that during the winter, Grand Duc Mines have more men watching over snowslides than the government has to take care of the Rogers Pass Highway, with no help from the government, I might say. 1973, with high copper prices, saw this a viable operation for the first time, 24 years after discovery. With royalties on top of heavy taxes and low copper prices, the future for this property and its shareholders is indeed grim. An experienced mine engineer, in referring to the Grand Duc, said, quote, "Man's triumph over some of the severest obstacles nature has ever placed in the path of mineral discovery and mine development. However one chooses to apportion the reasons for what happened to mining in British Columbia, during the years 41 to 73, the fact remains that these years saw development on a scale never before achieved in BC. I'd like to make the point here that the distribution of these mines, you can't read them all, I'm sure, but you can see the little red marks, and you can see the two green, which are the two that aren't copper. All the red ones are copper mines, and they extend right up to the north. And these are the mines that resulted from that period of prospecting, beginning, I suppose, with the discovery of Grand Duc in 1948 up till 1973. And later on, I'll show you some figures to give you an idea of just how important that was. But I wanted to show that the whole of the province, from the southeast to the northwest, benefited by this money that was poured into the country. And I'd like to show you just briefly how this showed up. I might say that all these charts would not have been possible but for Professor Evans' kindness in helping to prepare them.
You'll notice the one that I want you to see is copper, the top right-hand side. And you can see this changed the whole picture of mining. The lead, the zinc were down. Coal, of course, was up. And I'm not discussing coal in this talk. And gold has just started to turn up. If you'd gone on a few months more, gold production would have increased. But this was not due to gold mining, but due to gold produced as a byproduct from the base metal mines. It is worth observing that taking inflation into account and remembering that as yet we have no open pit gold mines, either in operation or even in prospect, in our province the price of gold would have to rise to between 4 and 5 times the 1938 price before we could even hope to get gold production back to where it was in World War II commenced, i.e., it must go to at least 140 to 175. And my mining friends tell me I'm too darn conservative with that. It should go to 175 to 200. This fact may explain to anybody holding gold stocks why, in part at least, they have to thank Bill 31 for the disappointing showing made in those stocks in recent months. However, coming events cast their shadow. The exciting events of the past decade, that last decade, were not to last. In 1967, the Carter Report recommended immediate cancellation of special treatment with respect to mining taxation. This was followed in the 1971 budget under the terms of the federal tax reform proposed the gradual withdrawal of incentives for exploration, development, and mining. Then in 1974, further changes were proposed in the federal government's spring budget, designed to spring up the withdrawal of those incentives that remain. On the government being defeated on this budget, they went to the country and won a new mandate. A new budget did give some concession to the industry in making more generous allowances for prospecting, but adamantly refused to consider allowing any credit towards cost brought about by the provincial government's new royalty tax, which had been promulgated in 1974. There the matter stands. The industry has pointed out that a royalty tax in its present form makes no allowance either for the grade of ore we are mining, some of the lowest grade ore being mined anywhere in the world today, or for high-cost producers who have to face grim prospects when prices are low, actually having to pay heavy taxes when they are losing money. For some of these mines, it would be the height of folly to shut down, and normally they would count on the cyclic recurrence of higher prices to recoup their losses and repay their heavy capital outlays. I think that I have shown what the mining industry can do, has done, and would do under favorable political conditions. The outlook is, however, gloomy, unless our provincial and Dominion governments can arrange some compromise which will permit a siphoning off of something less than 50% of the net taxable profits of mining companies. Even Mr. Turner has aimed at making the total tax on industry less than 50%. Mining, if it is to attract either government or private capital, for reasons already outlined, should have a somewhat lower rate of taxation. I would now like to turn to the third and last part of my talk and deal with some criticisms of the mining industry. I think one of the criticisms most often heard, why do the mines smelt their own ore in British Columbia, thereby receiving a greater part of the value of the ore? It seems to be news to some people that attempts have been made to do this in the past. And Table 8. I must apologize to Professor Evans. He had another beautiful one here that I want to mention, so I may go back just a step. This shows the growth, and when you realize that $500 million of that is copper, you can see what copper did for the province in those few years. I'd also like to draw your attention to the marking at the bottom, where the average value of mineral production per capita was $130 in 1901, In 1961, it was 110, but by 1973, it was 430. This was the result of what we in the industry, at any rate, considered to be wise taxation policies. And now, you hear so much in the paper about why don't we smelt our own ores. Here is a list of the copper, lead, and zinc smelters that we've had in the province over the years. And there are only two of them that are still going, the one at Trail and the one at Kitimat. And they go because they have cheap energy, cheap and attractive energy, which enables them to produce a product which can compete in the world's markets. And if you'll notice, all the others have gone broke. Some of them worked for 14, 15 years, but they didn't survive any longer. Now, to operate a smelter, and I see there are a few experts here, I have to be careful. Perhaps they'll help me out if I get into trouble. To operate a smelter profitably, many factors must be taken into account, including an assured long-term supply of ore, a reasonably assured market. Remember, if you smelt an ore, you have to sell the darn stuff. Whereas if you get someone else to smelt it, they have the job of selling it. And it helps to sell it when you have a good clout. If you have 100 million people behind you, you can ask for things that you can't when you have 2 million. You must have also a firm knowledge of environmental requirements and a definite commitment with respect to taxation. Several projects have been submitted to the BC government with respect to building a smelter in BC. To the best of my knowledge, no answers to the above questions have yet been received. Two, mining operations are unsightly and destroy the environment. Now, although I'm not able to agree entirely with my friend Harold Wright, who I think was speaking with his tongue in his cheek, he was credited with once saying that he thought open pits were beautiful, I have noticed that two open pits known to most of you have been made most attractive. I refer to Bouchard's Gardens in Vancouver Island and part of Little Mountain Park in Vancouver, both of which were once rock quarries. Some of you may be old enough to remember them. It is doubtful if it would be justifiable to lavish comparable amounts of money and loving care on some of the open pits left in some of the more remote parts of the country. However, what mining companies have or have not done in the past is not now a matter of concern. Today, every mining company is compelled by law to leave their property as it was before their operation commenced, insofar as the government department concerned deems it to be practical. Moreover, in order to guarantee that this law is complied with, a substantial performance bond has to be posted, and this may amount to as much as some hundreds of thousands of dollars. In this connection, it may be well to point out these mining disturbances in perspective, and I quote from a pollution control report recently published by the Mining Association of Canada. Incidentally, for over a year after this has been made available, there has been no criticism, and so I suspect that it's probably pretty correct. I think that table, to me, as a geologist, is very satisfying if you look at the fact that we have 2.28 billion acres. We have 172 million acres under agriculture. We have roughly 3.8 million acres under highways. And the total disturbance on the whole of Canada is 130,000 acres for all the mines operating in Canada. In British Columbia, I have, thanks again to Mr. Tuff, some excellent figures, and which can be taken as authoritative because they're got out by the government. In British Columbia, all ground that is to be occupied for any mining purpose whatever must by law be reported. Thus we know precisely how much land is occupied by mining. Mine buildings, open pits, quarries, gravel pits, coal mines of all types exploration involving bulldozers and all placer operations occupy just over 40 square miles out of the province's 366,255 square miles. By comparison, all roads in BC occupy 530 square miles, calculating road widths at only 100 feet. Recently, in Nova Scotia, protests were launched concerning the destruction caused by to the environment by mines. The Deputy Minister of Mines pointed out that the one highway from Halifax to Truro had disturbed as much as 80% of the land as mining had done throughout the whole of Nova Scotia's history. Everybody would agree that roads and power lines are necessary adjuncts to our modern society. Comparisons are odious, so I shall content myself merely by suggesting that by giving up 1 acre in every 10,000 of our province for mining, we are getting good value for our land. Thirdly, mining leaves behind ghost towns. Now, this has already been dealt with to a large extent. But it's only fair to point out that all across Canada, and particularly in the prairies, there are to be seen towns that were once the centers of agricultural activity. Times have changed, and many of these people have moved to urban communities. Does that mean that it was wrong to initiate those communities? And should agriculture or mining be blamed for the moving of population to more populated centers? There is an old saying that good mines die hard. This has been witnessed many times in British Columbia. Greenwood, Merritt, Princeton, Ashcroft, and Williams Lake alike show how new developments can rejuvenate old mining centers. Anybody who has visited Logan Lake and Fraser Lake would probably agree that the mining town of today is really different from its counterpart of 30 years ago. It could be claimed that some of the mining communities of today offer opportunities to escape from urban contamination and also have within their reach all the fresh air and water, not to speak of pristine wilderness that so many claim to want and so few are willing to make the sacrifices necessary to obtain. 4. It is essential that we preserve ecological reserves, and mining operations pose a threat to this objective. Dr. Kraina, who is a devout believer in ecological reserves, and who phoned just a few minutes ago to apologize for not being here, he's down with the flu, but I know if he were here, he would endorse what I am saying now. Dr. Kraina, who is a devout believer in ecological reserves, discussed this problem with me last month. I think I may safely say we agreed that because neither ecological reserves nor mining would require in the foreseeable future more than 0.1% of the land area of British Columbia, there was lots of room for both of us with the exercise of common sense and a little goodwill. Earlier I stated that if mining had made mistakes, they could and indeed should be corrected. Every normal youngster makes mistakes. Students, and indeed faculty members who should know better, break the law regularly, which is surely much more serious. Now, even the most critical would not want these offenders strangled. They should be helped and encouraged to mend their ways. Similarly, the mining industry, which does so much to contribute to our standard of living, that we, the people, simply cannot afford to let it be unnecessarily crippled as it is being at the present time. One other problem must be faced, and this is a problem not only for mining, but for all the primary industries. Much of our primary and partially manufactured and wholly manufactured goods can only be produced if they can be sold competitively on the open markets of the world. Labor, speaking collectively, dislikes industries which are energy intensive and light on manpower. They, like the rest of us, dislike dangerous, boring, repetitive, wearying, and lonely jobs. Nevertheless, they want a minimum wage and want to share in the good things of life. As a result of the combination of the above facts of life, all of which are continually being verified and emphasized, we in British Columbia, and also in the rest of Canada, are wasting much of our natural wealth. From one end of Canada to the other, food is being left to rot because harvesters cannot be paid what they feel they deserve. 2 years ago, I had the privilege of visiting many northern mines from Labrador to the Yukon. All of them were in need of more workers, but the workers preferred to stay in town, consuming wealth and producing nothing, in short, contributing directly to unemployment and inflation. Our country is so rich in natural wealth that we have survived remarkably well so far. Alas, it is becoming increasingly obvious that unless we take steps to put a little common sense and backbone into our political representatives, who, you may remember, only do what they think the majority of us want them to do, we may be in for days as dark or darker as those some of us remember from the days of the Great Depression. I have as great a measure of compassion as any social worker, but we would not be showing genuine compassion if by failing to take remedial measures, our whole country went back to the Dark Ages. At this point, I'm going to make a suggestion for all of you to take home and ponder on before you start calling me nasty names. Alternatively, you are free to make a better suggestion. I myself cannot think of a better one for the moment, at any rate. Here's the problem. There are many necessary but unpleasant jobs to do. Two, somehow we have to find men and women to do these jobs. Three, if these jobs are not done, our society as we know it will grind to a halt. Capital, labor, and government will continue to face confrontations, and our present day dog-eat-dog tactics will continue. A fact. Nobody has yet come up with an equitable and generally acceptable way of persuading people to do these jobs. The solution. Every man and woman must do something for their country before they have the right to call on their country to look after them. In short, I would prescribe 3 years of national service for every man and woman before they are allowed to proceed, largely at the state's expense, to higher education or to any chosen avocation. Every citizen would have an obligation to serve on any of the armed forces or to work in any of the primary industries. It might be possible for religious and conscientious objectors to do their stint in one of the more boring of the service industries. During the time people were fulfilling their obligations to their fellow citizens, they would receive food, clothing, board, and pocket money, but no more. In this way, unemployment would diminish, and wealth would be produced, not merely distributed and redistributed. Other countries have found this necessary, and surely we can take advantage of history and experience. It is said that people who do not read history have to live it. By capitalizing on our democratic heritage, we should be able, no doubt after a period of trial and error, to develop a new and more intelligent society. The men and women who have experienced the rigors of the North, the boring repetitiveness of some farming, mining, or service routines, will never in the future view the production and distribution of wealth in quite the same way. I cannot imagine anybody agreeing with the above suggestion, but surely I am justified in asking you to come up with a better one. An old friend and employer of mine, R.E. Legg, provided me the other day with a quotation which, while I would not be so unwise as to suggest that it had any possible connection with this audience, might be taken to heart elsewhere. And I quote, "Against stupidity, even the gods themselves contend in vain." End quote. This was from a German of the 19th century, Schiller. Now, to end on a challenging, or what I hope is a challenging note, if I can... I seem to have lost it. Well, fortunately, I have it all in my head anyway. I had a list
of some dozen minds which, before the laws were changed, suggested that we could bring into production something over 300,000 tons of waste rock and turn it into ore every day at a cost of $2 billion worth of new capital. This, as you can see, would more than double the total mining production of the whole province of British Columbia prior to 1973. And I don't think it requires a genius to realize that this could be extremely important. With the help of Professor Evans, it's been possible to make that rough estimate, and I just would like to repeat again, at a capital cost of more than $2,000 million, something more than 300,000 tons of waste might have been converted into ore every day, more than the total of substances mined daily at the present time. Furthermore, many of these mines are in central and northern British Columbia, where they could further be stated objectives, where they aid further the stated objectives of successive governments. Alas, as Shakespeare wrote, there is a tide in the affairs of men, which taken in the flood leads on to fortune. Omitted all the voyage of their life is bound in shallows and in miseries. And we must take the current when it serves or lose our ventures. 2 or 3 years ago, we might have caught the current when it served. Today, the outlook is gloomy. The price of copper has had its accustomed downturn, and unsympathetic legislation has added to the dismal prospects being faced by the mining industry today. It is not possible, I repeat, it is not possible to take much solace in the belief, widely held in some quarters, that by leaving it in the ground, we will be leaving something for future generations. Few people care to foretell the future, and those that attempt to do so are often wrong. I would find it difficult to look many months ahead, much less years. In the case of copper, to leave it in the ground now is probably going to leave it in the ground for several decades, if not centuries. Other large and richer copper deposits are being discovered every year. We should capitalize on our techniques for dealing with low-grade ores as soon as practical. I would like to close on a cheerful note by quoting what someone once wrote in my autograph album. And unless you think I'm not bilingual, I'm going to give you a sentence in French. Après la pluie, le beau temps. Souvenez-vous toujours, et vous ne serez jamais triste. After the rain comes the sunshine. Remember that, and you will never be sad. I can remember what gold did for the province, and I would like to think that in the years ahead, copper, molybdenum, and other metals might do the trick again. Let me assure you that if mining were given the appropriate political and economic climate, it could add greatly to the fundamental wealth of the country. It could provide work and wages, business to the supporting industries, interest to the moneylenders, taxes to all governments, not to speak of satisfaction to that large number of men and women who over the last 20 years have made British Columbia a center of mining expertise that is known and respected throughout the world. Unfortunately, as some of you no doubt anticipated, the price of copper, which for a short time rose to the dizzy heights of $1.40 a pound, returned to below 60 cents a pound. And this fact, together with the uncertainties and royalties introduced by Bill 31, will effectively mothball most of these projects for many months, if not years. The naming of gold as a designated mineral has, so far, prevented gold from playing the part it did in the 1930s when it gave British Columbia a real start in climbing out of the Depression. In short, ladies and gentlemen, the fate of mining in British Columbia lies in your hands and in the hands of people like you. You alone can decide whether our mines are mines of gold or dross. I am sure our industry would wish me to say to you, give us the tools so we can get on with the job. Tour missed.
Baker trustee. Dr. Warren will take questions from the audience. Yes, Eric.
Terry, there was a complete absence of new gold mines, or more or less complete absence of new gold mines. Did I take you to say that the gold was in the ground, but it just wasn't profitable to remove it as it was 30 or 40 years ago? Is that right?
Yes, I tried to make the point that when we had the boom in the 30s, it was because the price of gold had been raised from $20 to $35. And I pointed out that by 1938, that had built up 25 producing mines. But since 1928, we have to multiply that 40 by somewhere between 4 and 5 to get the dollar equivalent, gold having had a fixed price in between. So that it would have to go to, most people say, between $175 and $200 an ounce to put us back where we were in 1938. But unfortunately, the government have declared gold as a prescribed mineral, and they set the price at $84. And they've said that anything above $84, they take half the profit. And this, of course, in effect means that something like $200 gold, you've got to take 60 and makes it back to 140. Now, a lot of people are sharpening their minds, and before Bill 31 came in last year, there were at least two of the major companies spending between $500,000 and $1 million to refurbish the mines and reopen the camp. And we have every reason to believe that if the price of gold were to go to $200, and if the tax of what would be $160 were taken off, there might be a resurgence in gold mining. Now, unfortunately, every one of those, except one, I think, was stopped. And they continued their work. They had an $800,000 program last year, and they did it on the faith of Mr. Nimsick, who wrote and said, you know, we're really nice people and we'll treat you properly. And those directors decided to take them at his word. The other directors weren't quite so sanguine, and the money's still waiting to be put into them. No, no, that's the provincial government, 31. No, the trouble between the provincial and the federal government is that the federal government now got rather tired of the provincial government putting up the taxes. Up till now, we've been allowed our provincial taxes as a credit against our costs. But now the provincial and the federal government are arguing as to which is to get the money, and we don't get any.
Yes.
I can. Which percentage of Canadian mining is Canadian owned? If you can amuse yourself for about 10 seconds, I can give you the exact figure here. But it's about 70%, I think. Mr. Tuff is in the audience. Can you tell me that off the top of your head?
Yeah, the British Columbia alone, I can't speak for the rest of Canada because I don't think the study has been done. British Columbia alone, the mines are at least 69.7% controlled by Canadians. And 57% owned by Canadians.
I have the official figures here for those who want it. 58% of the major mining operations in British Columbia were owned by Canadian and 69% controlled by Canadians. I don't know if Mr. Hobbs would like to confirm that or not. Is it fair my asking someone in the audience? But I'd like some of the experts to.
Not an expert, but I think that's borne out by a lot of excellent opinions.
Well, we happen to have in the audience here one of the greatest experts on this subject, Professor Evans, and I don't know whether he wants me to answer for him or whether he'd care to get up and
give it. But he prepared a survey of all the producing mines around the Pacific Rim and elsewhere. And in short, we are the lowest grade by a very substantial figure.
0.43 for British Columbia, going up to just on 1% for Chile.
Can you all hear that? 0.43 is the average grade of all the material known in British Columbia, going up to 1% in Chile. So that whereas we are trying to produce a little over 8 pounds to the ton, they are producing something like 20 pounds of copper to the ton. In other words, emphasizing my point that it's our expertise that we have developed in this province for this low-cost open-pit mining, which is second to none in the world. Sounds like a nasty question. If you can suggest a good way of holding the population level, I would say amen to that. But the trouble is the population has gone on increasing, and whether you blame the miners for that, I don't know. But the fact is that we are having more and more demands made on us for goods and services, and it's only by producing wealth that we can satisfy these demands. I would hope that I could agree with you 100%. As soon as we stabilize this, we can look forward to a much more sensible and happy society. But at the present moment, we haven't done it. And the world population, as you know, is increasing at the rate of about 80 million every year. And until we slow that up, we're not going to get any of the stabilization that I think you're right in looking forward to.
There's one more.
May I call on Professor Evans, the head of mineral engineering, to thank our speaker? I would.
Thank you, Mrs. Armstrong. Harry, I've been asked on behalf of the Vancouver Institute to convey their thanks for your presentation. It looks like a put-up job, me being asked to thank you and you're referring to me in your address. Now, Harry did throw out a couple of points that I think I can answer one of them anyhow. He asked how many people in the audience have tried to do single jacking. I'm sure there are very few. I did try once. And the story was, if you're a good man single jacking, you could get 1 foot in 1 hour. Well, I wasn't actually single jacking, I had a helper. We got 16 inches in about a day and a quarter. So I must admit that I'm no good at single jacking. The other thing that Harry pointed out, of course, in his address, was that many of the discoveries made here have been made by graduates of the University of British Columbia. And he spoke of those people who could not see what Spud Huestis had at Bethlehem. I've learned something tonight. I realize now why I was one of those that turned it down, and I realize why I turned it down. I'm not a graduate of the University of British Columbia. For that, I apologize. But truly, Harry, on behalf of everybody, I'm sure everybody in the audience has learnt a good deal about the mining industry, that we could not have had a more informed person who, indeed, in giving us history, also had some nice little cracks to make here and there, and left us with some pretty good thoughts. Thank you very much indeed, Harry Warren.